Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, we were discussing how the banking system is already bankrupt. There may be some charge that imposing a 100% reserve requirement could bankrupt the banks, but the wizard would retort that the banking system is, frankly, already bankrupt. The 300-year fractional reserve Ponzi scheme has reached its mathematical endpoint. The bankers' chickens have come home to roost, and only a radical overhaul will save the system. Nouriel Roubini, professor of economics at New York University and a former advisor to the U.S. Treasury, gave this bleak assessment in a November 2007 newsletter. Quote, "I now see the risk of a severe and worsening liquidity and credit crunch leading to a generalized meltdown of the financial system of a severity and magnitude like we have never seen before. In this extreme scenario, whose likelihood is increasing, we could see a generalized run on some banks and runs on a couple of weaker non-bank broker-dealers that may go bankrupt with severe and systemic ripple effects on a mass of highly leveraged derivative instruments that will lead to a seizure of the derivatives markets, massive loans on money market funds, ever-growing defaults and losses, $500 billion plus in subprime, near-prime and prime mortgages, severe problems and losses in commercial real estate, the drying up of liquidity and credit in a variety of asset-backed securities, putting the entire model of securitization at risk. Runs on hedge funds and other financial institutions that do not have access to the Fed's lender of last resort support, and a sharp increase in corporate defaults and credit spreads. Close quote. We are reaching the point at which the private banking system can no longer be saved with the stream of accounting entry reserves to support an expanding pyramid of fractional reserve lending. The banks may need either to be nationalized or, as they were in Japan, to take up some other line of work. Chris Cook is a British market consultant who was formerly director of the International Petroleum Exchange. He observes that the true role of banks is to serve as guarantors and facilitators of deals. The seller wants his money now, but the buyer doesn't have it. He wants to pay over time. So the bank steps in and advances credit by creating a deposit from which the borrower can pay the seller. The bank then collects the buyer's payments over time, adding interest as its compensation for assuming the risk that the buyer won't pay. But the interests of creditors and debtors are opposed. The creditor actually makes more money when the debtor is financially strapped by keeping the debtor on the hook and increasing finance charges. A more congenial model is investment banking or Islamic banking, bringing investors together with projects in need of funds. The money already exists, the bank just arranges the deal and the issuance of stock. It is a joint venture rather than a creditor-debtor relationship. The investor makes money only if the company makes money, and the company makes money only if it produces goods and services that add value to the economy. The parasite becomes a partner, and there is no drain from profits in the form of interest without productivity to support it. Businesses and individuals do need a ready source of credit, and that credit could be created from nothing and advanced to borrowers under a 100% reserve system just as it is now. The difference would be that the credit would originate with the government, which alone has the sovereign right to create money, and the interest on it would be returned to the public purse. In effect, the government would just be serving as a credit clearing exchange, or as the accountant in a community system of credits and debits. And we'll discuss more on this later. Now, what about a system of national bank branches to service basic public banking needs? Hummel points out that if private banks could not leverage deposits into loans using fractional reserve banking, they would have little incentive to service the depository needs of the public. Depository functions are basically clerical and offer little opportunity for income except fees for service. Who would be left to service the public's banking needs if private banks lost interest in that business? In How Credit Money Shapes the Economy, Professor Gutman notes that our basic banking needs are fairly simple. We need a safe place to keep our money and a practical way to transfer it to others. These services could be performed by a government agency on the model of the now defunct U.S. Postal Savings System, which operated successfully from 1911 to 1967, providing a safe and efficient place for customers to save and transfer funds. It issued U.S. postal savings bonds in various denominations that paid annual interest, as well as postal savings certificates and domestic money orders. The U.S. postal savings system was set up to get money out of hiding, attract the savings of immigrants accustomed to saving at post offices in their native countries, provide safe depositories for people who had lost confidence in private banks, and furnish more convenient depositories for working people than were provided by private banks. Post offices then had longer hours than banks, being open from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. 6 days a week. The postal system paid 2% interest on deposits annually. The minimum deposit was $1 and the maximum was $2,500. savings in the system spurred it to $1.2 billion during the 1930s and jumped again during World War II, peaking in 1947 at almost $3.4 billion. The U.S. Postal Savings System was shut down in 1967, not because it was inefficient, but because it became unnecessary after private banks raised their interest rates and offered the same governmental guarantees that the postal system had had. I'll be back on this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The services offered by a modern system of federally operated bank branches would have to be modified to reflect today's conditions, but the point is that the government has done these things before and could do them again. Indeed, if fractional reserve banking were eliminated, those functions could fall to the government by default. Hummel suggests that it would make sense to simplify the banking business by transferring the depository role to a system of bank branches acting as one entity under the Federal Reserve. Among other advantages, he says, quote, since all deposits would be entries in common computer network, determining balances and clearing checks could be done instantly, thereby eliminating checking system float and its logistic complexities. And just as a footnote, float is the time that elapses between when a check is deposited and the funds are available to the depositor, during which the bank is collecting payment from the payer's bank. Continuing with the quote, with the Fed operating as the sole depository, payments would only involve the transfer of deposits between accounts within a single bank. This would allow for instant clearing, eliminate the nuisance of checking system float, and significantly reduce associated costs. Additional advantages, including the elimination of any need for deposit insurance and ending overnight sweeps and other sterile games that banks play to get around the fractional reserve requirement, end quote. Another footnote, the overnight sweep is a tactic for maximizing interest by sweeping funds not being immediately used in a low-interest account into a high-interest account where they remain until the balance in the low-interest account drops below a certain minimum. Now, in Hummel's model, the Fed would be the sole depository and only its branches would be called banks. Institutions formerly called banks would have to close down their depository operations and would become private financial institutions, PFIs, along with finance companies, pension funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, and the like. Some banks would probably sell out to existing PFIs. PFIs could borrow from the Fed just as banks do now, but the interest rate would be set high enough to discourage them from engaging in purely speculative games in the financial markets. Without the depository role, banks would no longer need the same number of branch offices. The Fed would probably offer to buy them in setting up its own depository branch offices. Hummel suggests that a logical way to proceed would be to gradually increase the reserve ratio requirement on existing depositories until it reached 100%. And another concept that comes up is the national credit card, a system of publicly owned bank branches to solve the credit card problem. Hummel notes that imposing a 100% reserve requirement on the banks would mean the end of the private credit card business. Recall that when a bank issues credit against a customer's charge slip, the charge slip is considered a negotiable instrument that becomes an asset against which the bank creates a liability in the form of a deposit. The bank balances its books without debiting its own assets or anyone else's account. The bank is thus creating new money, something private banks could no longer do under a 100% reserve system. But the ability to get ready credit against the borrower's promise to pay is an important service that would be sorely missed if banks could no longer engage in it. If your ability to use your credit card were contingent on your bank's ability to obtain scarce funds in a competitive market, you might find when you went to pay your restaurant bill that credit has been denied because your bank was out of lendable funds. The notion that money has to be there before it can be borrowed is based on the old commodity theory of money. Theorists from Cotton Mather to Benjamin Franklin to Michael Linton, who designed the Letts system, have all defined money as something else. It is simply credit, an advance against the borrower's promise to pay. Credit originates with that promise, not with someone else's deposit or something valuable in the bank. Credit is not dependent on someone else having given up its rights to an asset for a period of time, and reserves are not necessary for advancing it. What is wrong with the current system is not that money is advanced as a credit against the borrower's promise to repay, but that the interest on this advance accrues to private banks that gave up nothing of their own to earn it. This problem could be rectified by turning the extension of credit over to a system of truly national banks, which would be authorized to advance the full faith and credit of the United States as agents of Congress, which is authorized to create the national money supply under the Constitution. Credit card services actually are an extension of the depository functions of banks. The link with bank deposits is particularly obvious in the case of those debit cards that can be used to trigger ATM machines to spit out $20 bills. When you make a transfer or withdrawal on your debit card, the money is immediately transferred out of your account, just as if you had written a check. When you use your credit card, the link is not quite so obvious, since the money doesn't come out of your account until later. But it is still your money that is being advanced, not someone else's. Again, your promise to pay becomes an asset and a liability of the bank at the same time, without bringing any of the bank's or any other depositor's money into the deal. The natural agency for handling this sort of transaction would be an institution that is authorized both to deal with deposits and to create credit money with accounting entries, something a truly national bank could do as an agent of Congress. A government banking agency would not be driven by the profit motive to gouge desperate people with exorbitant interest charges. Credit could be extended at interest rates that were reasonable, predictable, and fixed. In appropriate circumstances, credit might even be extended interest-free, which I will discuss later. The branch offices set up by a truly Federal Reserve would not need to be new entities, and they would not need to take over the whole banking business. They could be existing banks that had been bought by the government or picked up in bankruptcy. As we'll see later, the same mega banks that handle a major portion of the nation's credit card business today may already be insolvent, making them prime candidates for FDIC receivership and government takeover. If just those banking giants were made government agencies, they might provide enough branches to service the depository and credit card needs of the citizens, leaving the lending of pre-existing funds to private financial institutions, just as is done now. Note that the government would not actually have to run these new bank branches. The FDIC could just hire new management or give the old management new guidelines, redirecting them to operate the business for the benefit of the public. As in any corporate acquisition, not much would need to change beyond the names on the stock certificates. Business could carry on as before. The employees would just be under new management. The banks could advance loans as accounting entries, just as they do now. The difference would be that interest on advances of credit, rather than going into private vaults for private profit, would go into the coffers of the government. The full faith and credit of the United States would become an asset of the United States. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, what about a money supply that regulates itself? Hummel points to another wrinkle that would need to be worked out in a 100% reserve system. The extension of credit by private banks plays an important role in regulating the national money supply. Public borrowing is the national determinant of money growth. When banks extend credit, the money supply expands naturally to meet the needs of growth and productivity. If a 100% reserve requirement were imposed, the money supply would not grow in this organic way, so growth would have to be brought about by some artificial means. One alternative would be for the government to expand the money supply according to a set formula. Milton Friedman suggested a fixed 4% per year. But such a system would not allow for modifying the money supply to respond to external shocks or varying internal needs. Another alternative would be to delegate monetary expansion to a monetary board of some sort, which would be authorized to determine how much new money the government could issue in any given period. But that alternative, too, would be subject to the vagaries of human error and manipulation for private gain. We've seen the roller coaster results when the Fed has been allowed to manipulate the money supply by arbitrarily changing interest rates and reserve requirements. The Great Depression was blamed on Fed tinkering. Why does the money supply need to be manipulated by the Federal Reserve? Consumer loans are self-liquidating. The new money they create is eventually paid back and zeros out. But that result is skewed by the charging of interest and by the fact that the burgeoning federal debt never gets repaid but just keeps growing. The money supply expands because government securities, or debt, are sold to the Federal Reserve and to commercial banks, which buy them with money created out of thin air, and it is this unchecked source of expansion that has to be regulated by artificial means. In a system without a federal debt and without interest, consumer debt should be able to regulate itself. That sort of model is found in the Letts system, in which money is created when someone pays someone else with credits, and it is liquidated when the credits are used up. Here is an example. Jane bakes cookies for Sam. Sam pays Jane one Letts credit by crediting her account and debiting his. Money has just been created. Sam washes Sue's car, for which Sue gives Sam one Letts credit, extinguishing the debit in his account and creating one in hers. Sue babysits for Jane, who pays with the Letts credit Sam gave her. The books are now balanced, and no inflation has resulted. There is no longer any money in the system, but there is still plenty of credit, which can be created by anyone just by doing work for someone else. The Letts system is a community currency system in which no gold or other commodity is needed to make it work. Money, or in this case credit, is generated by the participants themselves. Projecting this account-tallying model onto the larger community known as a nation, money would come into existence when it was borrowed from the community-owned bank, and it would be extinguished as the loans were repaid. This is actually how money is generated now, but the creators of this public credit are not the community at large, but are private bankers who distort the circular flow of the medium of exchange by siphoning off a windfall profit in the form of interest. The charging of interest, in turn, creates the impossible contract problem, the spiral of inflation and unrepayable debt, resulting when more money must be paid back than is created in the form of loans. In community Letts systems, this problem is avoided because interest is not charged, but an interest-free national system is unlikely to happen anytime soon, and interest serves some useful functions. It encourages borrowers to repay their debts quickly, discourages speculation, compensates lenders for foregoing the use of their money for a period of time, and provides retired people with a reliable income. How could these problems be retained without triggering the impossible contract problem? As Benjamin Franklin might have said, that is simple. So now we'll look at the question of interest, solving the impossible contract problem. And from The Wizard of Oz saying to the Scarecrow, "Back where I come from, we have universities, seats of great learning, where men go to become great thinkers. And when they come out, they think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have. But they have one thing you haven't got, a diploma." Like Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln, Benjamin Franklin was a self-taught genius. He invented bifocals, the Franklin stove, the odometer, and the lightning rod. He was also called the father of paper money. He did not actually devise the banking system used in colonial Pennsylvania, but he wrote about it, promoted it, and understood its superiority over the debt-based private British system. When the directors of the Bank of England asked what was responsible for the booming economy of the young colonies, Franklin is reported to have said, quote, "That is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it to pay the government's approved expenses and charities. We make sure it is issued in proper proportions to make the goods pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to no one. You see, a legitimate government can both spend and lend money into circulation, while banks can only lend significant amounts of their promissory banknotes, for they can neither give away nor spend but a tiny fraction of money the people need. Thus, when your bankers here in England place money in circulation, there is always a debt principal to be returned and usury to be paid. The result is that you have always too little credit in circulation to give the workers full employment. You do not have too many workers, you have too little money in circulation, and that which circulates all bears the endless burden of unpayable debt and usury." End quote. That is what Franklin is reported to have said, but the words may have been put into his mouth later. Whoever said them, they are a succinct explanation of the advantages of the Pennsylvania banking system he favored over the British system. Since the provincial bank was a public institution, the profits returned to the local government rather than being siphoned off by external lenders. In an article titled "A Monetary System for the New Millennium," Canadian money reformer Roger Langrick explained the impossible contract problem in contemporary terms using an example in which $100 is lent at 10%. The result of creating 100 and demanding 110 in return is that the collective borrowers of a nation are forever chasing a phantom which can never be caught, the mythical $10 that were never created. The debt, in fact, is unrepayable. The only solution at present is increased borrowing to cover the principal plus the interest of what has been borrowed. That's the end of that quote. A better solution, says Langrick, would be to allow the government to issue enough new debt-free money to cover the interest charges not created by the banks on loans. Quote, "Instead of taxes, government would be empowered to create money for its own expenses up to the balance of the debt shortfall. Thus, if the banking industry created $100 in a year, the government would create $10, which it would use for its own expenses. Abraham Lincoln used this successfully when he created $500 million of greenbacks to fight the Civil War." Close quote. And we will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.